This is Radio Boston. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. News from Capitol Hill dominated the pages of the Globe and the Herald and airtime on WBUR this week. A pretty impressive feat considering how little Congress has actually done. No repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, no DREAM Act, no spending bill, and no financial help for 9/11's first responders. Back home, some interesting stories may have gotten short shrift. The young man who conned his way into Harvard pled guilty to fraud, thus avoiding jail time. Former Boston City Councilor Chuck Turner probably is heading to jail on felony corruption charges, but that didn't stop him from suing his old colleagues this week for setting up a special election to replace him. And the family of a Roxbury woman won a huge judgment in what may be the most racially charged big tobacco lawsuit yet. We'll get to all of that in our News of the Week in Review very soon. But first, there is one piece of breaking news today, and that's that the Patrick administration has just announced that from now on, if you are arrested by Massachusetts State Police for any reason, your immigration status will be checked. And if you're found to be here illegally, the state will report you to federal immigration officials. WBUR's Bianca Vasquez-Tonez is here to explain. Hi, Bianca.
Hey, Sasha.
And listeners, if this sounds familiar to you, it's because Boston police have been doing the same thing now for some time. And Bianca Vasquez-Tonez here with me is the one who broke that story. So, Bianca, explain briefly what this program is about.
Basically, what it means is that when the state police book someone, they've arrested them, they book them, they send that information on to the feds. Right now, they aren't sharing that information with immigration officials, and in the future, they're going to. It's part of a program that's called Secure Communities, and it's something the feds have been pushing on all the states.
So you said once someone is booked, so this only applies to people who are arrested. It's not like a state police officer might say, you look like you're Mexican, I'm pulling you over.
That's what the feds say. That's how they look at it. They're saying that they look at your status only once they've taken your fingerprints and put you into the big database and checked you out that way. And they look and see what kind of convictions you might have in your past and what kind of crimes you've done.
And then once the feds have that information from the states, what do federal officials do with that information?
Well, someone in immigration will look at that information and they'll determine if your crime is big enough. Whether they should hold you. And they'll, you know, communicate with state police and say, you know, we want that person. Please hold them. Keep them in jail until we can come get them.
What if they run your fingerprints and they found that you haven't committed no crimes, but they do find that you're in the country illegally?
Well, the feds say they're not supposed to hold you in that case. Mm. But, of course, advocates worry that that is what's happening and what's going to happen as they roll this out in more and more places.
So basically, at this point, no one is saying this means that just anyone who looks like an immigrant could get pulled over and have their fingerprints checked. It's just that if you're arrested for something else, that's when the database crunches the numbers. And if there are immigration issues, it may become an issue.
Right. The feds have sort of argued that this is free of racial profiling because the police, the state police, are kind of passive in this because they just arrest people for, you know, whatever reason they're arresting them for. And they have no control about, you know, whether their information is checked or not. It just automatically gets checked. Everyone they arrest is going to get checked, not just certain people.
So we're going to have to wait and see exactly how this goes into practice in Massachusetts once it starts being used. And I'm sure we'll be checking back with you.
Yes.
So, Bianca, thank you very much.
Thank you, Sasha.
That's WBUR's Bianca Vasquez-Tonez. Now let's go on and talk about the week's other top stories with Boston Globe editorial page editor Peter Kanellis. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Sasha.
And Boston Globe columnist Renee Loth. Hi, Renee.
Hello.
So let's start on Capitol Hill, which I mentioned earlier has very much dominated the news this week. And the House and Senate both voted to extend the Bush tax cuts for all income groups, middle class, no matter how rich you are. Massachusetts Senator Scott Brown and John Kerry voted yes, along with Congressman Nikki Tsongas and Congressman Bill Delahunt. Here's Scott Brown, who proposed this deal.
To get some certainty and stability, which is what the people need and what businesses need in this country, is very, very important. I commend the president.
Now, the seven remaining Massachusetts congressmen, all of them Democrats, voted no. And here's South Boston Democrat Steve Lynch.
There's a big difference between compromise and surrender. And what this bill represents is a complete surrender of Democratic principles and standing up for working people and making them carry an undue burden under this new tax law.
So Peter Kanellis and Renee Loth, again, that was Steve Lynch. He's probably the most conservative Democrat in the Massachusetts delegation, and he's staking out a very hard left position on taxes, also rebuking the leader of his party in the process. What is he trying to accomplish in doing this?
Steve
well,
Lynch.
I think,
go ahead, Peter.
No, I'll let Renee go ahead with this one.
You want to take it, Renee?
Well, I think the you know, the Democratic default position in this, other than the party leadership, but here in Massachusetts, the default position was to be against this deal because it gave too much money to the rich. It ballooned the ballooned the deficit, and you know, it's just a matter of fundamental fairness. What interests me about the way the vote came down were the two no votes in the Massachusetts delegation. You know, Bill Delahunt, as you said, and Nikki Tsongas. Delahunt, who is retiring, sort of has nothing to lose by this vote, but Nikki Tsongas, who has the least seniority of any of the members in the delegation, and who is something. Is a bit vulnerable politically, maybe has the most to lose, and yet they presented this kind of interesting bookends on the vote. And you know, I'd like to know if there's another story behind those no votes, but they're even more interesting to me than the yes votes.
What do you think, Peter? Do you sense is this just too principled in terms of Delahunt and Tsongas and the different results we saw from each of those?
Well, I think it is a true principle, and I think we saw people who are good liberals go both ways, and I think there's a very strong liberal case in favor of this tax deal. A lot of us were very, very scared that an austerity-minded Congress would really drag down the economy. I mean, we've seen that all of the gains in terms of job gains in the private sector have been erased by state governments cutting jobs, which has sort of sent the wrong signal at this particular moment. And if the Republican Congress is coming in January, the Republican House, you know, takes the lead and really starts paring the federal budget in the short term, as opposed to dealing with the long-term deficit busters, that would send a very negative signal to the economy and would be going back toward recession. This bill really protects us against that. This bill puts a lot of money in the hands of American consumers and will clearly be an economic benefit. I think liberals can rally around that point while disagreeing even very strongly with the extension of the Bush tax cuts for the rich.
Now, Renee, go
ahead. I just wanted to add that another really interesting political dynamic here has been the contrast between Brown's vote and Mitt Romney's view on this tax cut, on this tax deal, where he's very much against it. And I think that what's going on there is Mitt Romney feeling the hot breath of Sarah Palin and wants to make sure that there's any daylight between the two of them on this important issue.
Let's talk also about Don't Ask, Don't Tell. The U.S. House this week voted to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Now the Senate is set to vote on this tomorrow. Senator Scott Brown told WBUR that if there is a vote on repeal, he will break with his fellow Republicans and vote in favor.
As I said, I would read the report. I would meet with the generals on the ground and the service chiefs and Secretary Gates and everybody else and make my decision. I made my decision. It's pretty clear. I mean, I'm going to support it when it comes up. And it can come up next week and come up next year. You know, I'll support it.
Now, Scott Brown has taken a hit on this. You know, his position has been, let's say, nuanced. And I wonder whether, in your view, Renee, this constitutes a flip-flop, as some people have said.
Well, you know, Scott Brown was for the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell before he was against it, before he was for it. So, you know, I think he's got something to answer for. There were some procedural reasons for him to be against it in that intervening vote. You know, I know he did hear from a lot of his constituents on this matter, and I think he's made the right choice.
I wonder, Peter, if in some ways this was going to be a losing issue for Scott Brown no matter what he did.
Well, a little bit, but I think Scott Brown has actually done pretty well up to this point in winning, you know, support and respect from people in Massachusetts for kind of standing in the middle of all these issues and sort of being a force for kind of parsing these things through and not just taking an ideological stance. But on this one, where Don't Ask, Don't Tell is such a, you know, gut kind of issue, he's kind of got himself tied up in knots. And it's probably to his credit that he's going to vote for it, and that seems to be the logical, consistent path that he's been heading. But all of the twists and turns have really annoyed people, and I think it's hurt him politically.
So there's been an expectation that if Don't Ask, Don't Tell isn't repealed this year, then there's no way it's going to happen when the incoming Republican House shows up. So do the two of you, Peter Kanellis and Renee Law, think that if Don't Ask, Don't Tell isn't repealed tomorrow, it's probably dead for the near term?
Well, I think it'll be more difficult. I don't know if it's dead.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you have to balance the fact that there will be more Republicans with the fact that more and more people have been supporting the repeal. So I think that, you know, the movement has all been in the side of you know, the repeal. And It would be a setback for sure, but I wouldn't rule it out in the next 2 years.
Let's also talk about the health care ruling this week, which was made by a federal judge in Virginia, although it potentially has Massachusetts impact. This is a federal judge named Henry Hudson. He ruled this week that the part of the federal health care reform law that says that people must buy health insurance is unconstitutional. So he's talking about the so-called individual mandate. And Judge Hudson wrote that requiring Americans to buy insurance, quote, exceeds the constitutional boundaries of congressional power. Here's Virginia Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli applauding that decision.
This case is not about health insurance. It is not about health care. It's about liberty. And the judge said as much in his order.
So Peter Canellis, that judge, that person talking just then basically said it's a matter of freedom. You should be free not to have health insurance if you don't want it. But of course, we here in Massachusetts have had to buy health insurance since we passed our health care reform law about 4 years ago. Now, Peter, I've referenced this before. You went to law school. I want to know from your perspective, if you think this federal judge's ruling in Virginia could potentially impact Massachusetts.
Well, it could impact Massachusetts, obviously, if it went to the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court declared an individual mandate to be unconstitutional. It is an interesting legal issue. There are many, many past instances where the court comes out in a conservative way to begin with and then over a period of time begins to accept the expansion of federal power. The income tax was once ruled unconstitutional. Labor laws were ruled unconstitutional. And in pretty short order, the courts turned around. So I think that, you know, this ruling may not stand for too much, but it is an interesting legal question, and it would represent some expansion of federal power. But I think it's one that the court can find its way to supporting.
Renee Loth, we just heard Peter Canellis say that, you know, if this goes to the U.S. Supreme Court, as many people think it may, it could affect Massachusetts. Your sense of whether it will get there?
Well, you know, I'm not a lawyer, but I can play one on radio. You know, I think that the federal government asks us to do plenty of things. You know, they require us to pay taxes. Of course, that maybe is enumerated, you know, in the Constitution. They require us to register for selective service. You know, many state governments, I know, I understand that states have more authority in this area than the feds do, but state governments do also require things of their citizens. I mean, it's an interesting question. I think it probably is getting to the Supreme Court because there have been conflicting decisions on other courts on the same question. So, but I really think that there's a way to reconcile those issues. Not to drag Mitt Romney into every issue here, but, you know, what is also interesting is watching him twist in the wind as he tries to oppose the federal mandate because it's the kind of thing that the Tea Partiers and, you know, conservative base want him to do. At the same time, of course, he was responsible, signed the Massachusetts law, which is quite similar.
Let's also talk about this big tobacco judgment that came down in Boston this week. This was a Boston jury that found that the tobacco company Lorillard, which makes Newport cigarettes, was liable in the death of Marie Evans. Marie was a Roxbury woman who died of lung cancer in about 2002 after a lifetime of smoking. She was in her 50s. Now, the company was accused of giving free cigarettes to little kids in Roxbury back in the 50s and 60s, and also of aggressively marketing Newport cigarettes to African Americans. Now, we've seen a lot of judgments against big tobacco over the last 15 years. I'm wondering if the two of you think this one is more of the same or somehow different. And there was big money here, $71 million compensatory damages, another $81 million yesterday in punitive damages.
Yeah, I think it is different because I believe it is the first jury trial to rule against a tobacco company, and certainly the first jury trial to rule against a company for its marketing practices. And so I do think that's a new step in the whole history of tobacco litigation. These tobacco companies do have very aggressive marketing techniques. They market, they've been accused of marketing to children even contemporaneously, not, you know, back 30, 40 years ago, with flavored cigarettes and...
Now outlawed flavored cigarettes,
right,
no longer, right.
And other of those types of things. So I think, you know, this opens up the door for a whole bunch of different lawsuits.
This morning, the son of the woman who died was on WBUR with his lawyer, and Bob Oakes asked this man what his family would do with the money, which is now at a jury judgment of about $152 million.
Well, the money doesn't bring my mother back. And, you know, obviously, if I had my choice, that's what I'd want.
So obviously he wasn't addressing head on what will they do with the money if they get it. But I guess the question is also, is this money likely ever to come in that amount? Will it likely settle for something less, or will it be quite a while before they see any money at all? Peter, you want to take that one?
Yeah, I think it will be quite a while. And there's a lot of difficult complications in this case. And initially there was some doubt even about the evidence of the extent to which Lorillard had been passing out free cigarettes. It was very anecdotal, the evidence, and it wasn't all that strong. So it's possible that the whole judgment could be overturned. Nonetheless, I think that believers in the tort system should applaud this decision, because for years and years and decades, the tobacco companies had obfuscated and had denied what they already knew about how dangerous their products were. And we're starting to see the wall crumble. It's been crumbling for about 2 or 3 decades now, and maybe it will finally collapse entirely. And if it does, and if it does through jury awards, I think that's a totally legitimate function. I know that it's jarring to people, particularly in the business world, to think of these companies being hit with these huge judgments, but that's the way the system's supposed to work.
On our show yesterday here on Radio Boston, we talked about how different the environment is today in terms of marketing tobacco than it was in the 50s and 60s when this woman supposedly had free cigarettes given to her as a kid. Now cigarette companies cannot hand out free cigarettes. They cannot market as directly to kids. But we had an interesting comment posted on our website at wbur.org/Boston. It was by a listener named Gene. And this is what he wrote. Yeah, in this country, don't look at what's going on in Africa, Russia, and developing countries around the world. And I'm wondering, is that an important dimension that we're forgetting? The marketing may not be as aggressive here in the U.S., but could it be just as aggressive in those developing nations?
Absolutely. I mean, the tobacco companies make a huge amount of their profits overseas and have moved the base of their operations essentially overseas. I think that every country is going to have to deal with this on its own, unfortunately, but the actions of the tobacco companies overseas are not something to be proud of.
Another item that happened this week is that this 24-year-old man named Adam Wheeler, this was the man who had conned his way into Harvard, and yesterday he pled guilty, he apologized, he has to pay about $46,000 in restitution to Harvard, but he avoids jail in the process. Although I wonder, in the two of your views, is this more embarrassing for this kid or for Harvard that the kid actually got in and was able to almost pull this off? Renee, Peter.
Yeah, I'd say it's embarrassing for Harvard at least as much as the kid. I mean, the kid has serious problems, but Harvard, I think, needs to do a very thorough examination of its admission standards, because now it's very, very easy on all these computer systems to fake a transcript, to fake a recommendation, to fake a lot of things, and I still think most universities are kind of in denial about the extent to which their admission standards are vulnerable to this kind of fakery. And I have a feeling, just from having talked to some college presidents and some college admissions directors at various times when we've had meetings on this, that they kind of don't want to know. And I think they need to know, and they need to work harder on this.
Before we go this week, as the two of you know, at the end of our week in review, we do this thing called Hubbub, where we have one of you talk about some little story that caught your eye. Maybe it was below the radar. Renee, do you want to start and tell us what your Hubbub is?
The Pulitzer Prize-winning website, PolitiFact, which is an investigative website, has announced its so-called Lie of the Year. And it is the Republican assertion that the health care reform law was, quote, a government takeover of health care. They called that their lie of the year. Last year's lie was also related to health care. It was the lie about the death panels. Considering, the competition that they must have had for lie of the year out of Washington, I'd say that's quite an achievement.
And Peter Kanellis.
I think it's this discussion of the Cambridge City Council and the Boston City Council discussing ways to cooperate rather than compete for biotech jobs. Uh-huh. In this state, we have a terrible problem with next-door neighbors competing with each other, whether it's Holyoke and Springfield or Fall River and New Bedford or Lawrence and Lowell. These places should all be working together, and let's hope that Boston and Cambridge can start to set a good example. We're still a little ways away from that, but this is a first step.
I want to mention something historical, which is that yesterday was the anniversary date of the actual original Boston Tea Party. It happened on December 16th, 1773. And there was this cute story on NPR mentioning that the Boston Tea Party Ships and Museum occasionally gets calls from people saying, how can I sign up for the Tea Party movement? And they have to say, no, we're not the Tea Party movement. We're the actual Tea Party thing that happened in the 1700s, which I thought was really cute that they have to sort of fend off calls who think that they're the modern day political movement. It's also worth noting that that museum actually burned down a few years ago. It's being renovated. I think next summer it's supposed to reopen, so there'll actually be a physical presence again for where to go if you want to go visit the Boston Tea Party area. So thank you very much to both of you.
Thank you. It's always great.
Thank you, Sasha.
Renee Loth is a Boston Globe columnist, and Peter Kanellis is editorial page editor of the Globe. We are about to take a break, but when we come back, have you ever walked into a room and immediately forgotten why you went there? A researcher, the Brigham, is trying to figure out just how worried we should be about those senior moments. We'll be talking with her. And first, before we go, Radio Boston represents a significant investment by WBUR in local news. And it's an investment we've been able to make only because you have invested in us. So as we wrap up our end-of-year fundraising, please consider making a contribution for original local programming like this and everything else you value on WBUR. Here's how you can do that.